This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussions, news, and interviews, presenting The Film Scene with Ileana Douglas. Ileana is an actress, writer, author, and film historian with a need to discuss movies that borders on obsession. You'll learn the history of movies one great story at a time. The Film Scene is the deep cuts of movie podcasts, featuring movies we love by the people who made them. And now, Ileana Douglas.
Why, hello, everyone. Welcome to The Film Scene. I am Ileana Douglas. To my left is Ryan Nilsson.
Hello, hello. It's an honor to be here, not in the booth, but at the table this time around.
So we can put a face now to the... You're the man with the great hands. You always have the clip ready to go when reference
the images in the booth and that voice for the intro.
And you're all... That's right. That's also you, too. You're also a fantastic film fanatic.
That's right. Filmmaker. I studied film in college and made a bunch of shorts, and I'm just honored to be at the table with the great Ileana Douglas
today. It's going to be great. And with our guest, Tia Carrera, I'm very excited about. Of course, seen her in so many movies. We're going to be doing her intro in a minute, and she's on a new show on Netflix. God bless Netflix for doing all these really interesting shows. And I just want to say hello to our dear friend Jeff Graham. The reason he's not here is his wife's
grandmother
passed away. So he is back in Ohio. So just want to send thoughts and prayers to him. We love Jeff.
He's thinking about him.
Just a wonderful guy. And we're all a family here. So, but thank you again for... filling in. We're
going to
have a great show. So here we go. What's going on in the movie biz this week? Lots of stuff. Gene Hackman's birthday.
Happy birthday, Gene. I was thinking about, like, what is my favorite Gene Hackman movie? Because there's so many to pick from.
It's almost impossible.
Decades.
That's what I was thinking. What's so interesting about him is to have a career. Sometimes you think, well, people did well in the 60s, and then maybe they had a comeback. I mean, every decade.
I mean, all the way from like the French Connection through Unforgiven, where he's still getting nominated for things. One of my personal favorites is The Conversation. I think he is a revelation in the movie.
Incredible film. I posted on Twitter a couple of my favorites. Obviously, aside from his huge, you know, The French Connection and all those movies, I picked Scarecrow with Al Pacino, Gypsy Moths. With Burt Lancaster. It's a movie about skydiving, very kind of interesting film. The director of Gypsy Moths is John Frankenheimer. Frankenheimer directed French Connection 2.
Oh.
So they have that little...
connection right there.
Interesting connection. Prime Cut is another sort of a rare film
that he did,
70s film. And Night Moves, another interesting...
See, now, I know Night Moves. I have a few in there that I haven't seen the other two, but Night Moves is one of my favorites.
See, if you were in the booth, you would have already had the...
Picking all the photos and
all
everything.
All the photos up there. And then as far as comedies, I have to say Birdcage, when he's in drag.
All-time fave. Oh, that's my favorite Robin Williams. I adore that film.
Yeah.
He is terrific. He plays that comedic character, which we don't see him often.
No.
He is amazing. Just the very, like, the conservative father is running for re-election. And man, that ending. What a payoff.
Yeah.
That is incredible.
That God bless him. So thank God for Gene Hackman movies. This past week, I hosted they have the part of the Academy Awards luncheon, for the nominees luncheon.
Right.
And I was asked to be a part of it to announce where they do the roll call, where they name all the people. It's a few hundred people in every single category.
Really?
And they come out, and there's a gigantic riser, and they take the class photo.
Right.
The 92nd, class of 2019, and I have to say, it's just, that was my opening line, was just like, look around this room. Why would you want to be anywhere else but here? It's just Robert De Niro and Al Pacino, DiCaprio.
Especially with like this year we've had. 2019 was one of the best years in film in recent memory.
The variety of films and the directors.
So what was the energy of that room? Was it just like everyone, it's a joyous occasion?
Yes, I think it was, you know, it ends up being this thing that becomes very, very moving, you know, when you see all these filmmakers talking to other filmmakers.
Right.
I would have to say a highlight for me, I really wanted to get people's names right.
What was the tough one?
I'm up there for 37 minutes.
Wow.
I think, there was a few, Hildur Guðnadóttir, I think for Joker.
Yeah.
The music. I can't remember Gigorg. Sometimes now I don't remember what the film is, but there were many, many hard names. But the highlight for me was I walked up to Bong Joon-ho, and said his name to him. You know, that's all because suddenly it's like, I know you had a great movie, but I just want to make sure I get your name right. And I walked up to him and I just said, it's such an honor to meet you. Wow. I just want to make absolutely sure I'm saying your name right. It had his translator. And I said, you know, Bong Joon-ho. And he said, Cape Fear.
Oh my gosh, he did?
Very scary.
That is amazing. I love him so much.
He is
hilarious too. I mean, even with the Golden Globes, getting over that 1-inch barrier of subtitles, what a funny line for the translator to say. I cannot wait. I really hope Parasite gets recognized in a few categories, at least at the Oscars. I'm personally pulling for it for Best Picture, but we just rewatched it this past weekend, and it is a modern-day Hitchcock. Like, it is just amazing.
It's an incredible film. There's a number of films this year that, you know, that I just think are amazing. And like I said, the variety of films were just astonishing. So it was really fun just to see some people, Kathy Bates, who directed Me and 6 Feet Under, and you just run into people and you get a chance to just say how much their performance meant to you. So that's a lot of times, you know, it was funny. They had some bit about Brad Pitt wearing his name tag.
But
everybody's wearing their name
tag.
I saw
that.
And thank God they are, because you can say, oh, my God, you're the cinematographer of The Lighthouse. We could talk about it. So I got to
– wow.
There's so many movies I got to see, documentaries, short films. You know, somebody came
up. Have you seen them all?
Yes.
I watch them every year. I haven't seen this year's yet.
I watched everything. So I saw this woman coming through and I said, I know you guys, walk, run, cha-cha. So it was very, very emotional. I have to say, it was just an incredible, an honor for me.
They also announced who's going to be presenting a lot of the awards at the Oscars this year. It's coming up. I mean, we're a week and a half away. It's the awards, Super Bowl season, and I just cannot wait for the Oscars this year.
It's a big buildup, but regardless of who wins, that's why this class picture is so important, because it's just a moment to recognize the incredible honor, you know, that they're all winners, and it's not easy to make movies, and you're there. And I think it sort of dawns on people that day of just that recognition from everybody without the glare of the Oscars, like that, you know, the fact that we're all there, and then also to celebrate, you know, people who we just love, like Robert De Niro. It was really nice, the applause that he received, and it's just a sweet, sweet day, and it just was, it really was an incredible honor. I'm so thrilled to be part of talking about movies and, you know, brings us to the show and why we do the show.
So
we should probably let's get Tia in.
All right, cool.
You're gonna do double duties now. There he goes. Wish him luck. Tia Carrera is an incredible singer, 2-time Grammy Award winning singer. She's a former model. We're going to hear about how she got her big break. And, of course, you must know her from films such as True Lies, Wayne's World, Lilo and Stitch. And she's currently starring in a Netflix show, which is called AJ and the Queen, with RuPaul. Please welcome our guest, Tia Carrera. Hi, Tia.
Hello.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for inviting me. Nice to meet you.
It's our pleasure. So we always start the show off. I don't know how much of a movie buff you are, but I always like to ask people if you remember the first movie you saw and who took you to see it.
Well, the one that comes immediately to mind was standing in line for about an hour to get into Star Wars.
Uh-huh.
So I was one of those people that was, the theater's not even there anymore, but it was in Hawaii. And I think it was just me and I don't know if it was my sister and some friends just stood in line that went around the corner, around the block. And we were one of those, you know.
Seeing it. For the first, so there must have been some people that were in, because my recollection of the movie too is, you know, seeing it multiple times too. So there must have been some people that were there, not only for the first time, but the second and third time.
Oh, nobody in my neighborhood saw things more than once. They were lucky if they got to see one movie, I don't know, a month or every 6 months maybe.
Well, that's when movies were playing for months and months too. So it was,
yeah.
you had that opportunity.
Yeah, that was a magical one to see though. That was just like,
did you, when you came out of Star Wars, did you have a favorite character in Star Wars? Like, did you like Mark Hamill? Or
Harrison Ford was more to my taste.
That's so funny, yeah, because you would either.
As a kid, like for me to, you know, Han Solo was just, oh, so suave. And then I got to meet him at the Ford and Ferrari premiere just recently. I'm like, oh my gosh, I love you.
Oh, those are my favorite kind of meetings. When you see someone from your childhood, you just turn back to being a kid again.
Yeah.
That's incredible. So you were saying you grew up in Honolulu, and in all my massive research about you, it does.
Now it says a lot of years to research.
It says time and again that you were discovered in a grocery store. Is that really true?
It's true. It's not a made up PR story. I was actually shopping in a grocery store in Waikiki, mm-hmm. called the Food Pantry. And so I just came from a modeling shoot. So I had a garland of flowers on my head, full, you know, pancake makeup and a T-shirt and a bikini, you know. So it was like, oh, yeah, you blend at the grocery store. But a producer's mother and father came up to me and said, darling, you're gorgeous. You should be the lead in my son's movie. They're looking for the female lead. And I'm like, I never did any, you know, acting before.
Uh-huh.
I had sung, and that's, you know, so I was used to being in front of people and performing,
yes.
But no acting experience whatsoever, you know. They gave me the casting director's name and number. Her name was Caro Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And she cast the Karate Kid movies. So it was, you know, it wasn't some sort of back alley sort of,
right.
you know, creep. But I just went in and read and made pretend and got this movie.
And the movie was Aloha Summer.
Aloha Summer. Life was fine in 59. It was like a bunch of guys that came to Hawaii in 1959 and all their individual stories. And
uh-huh.
mine was a shy local Hawaiian girl falling in love with a Caucasian Casanova.
Always always a winning storyline.
Yeah, the Romeo and Juliet trope, you know.
So. Yes. But so you're suddenly thrust in front of the camera. I mean, were you nervous at all? Did you have any fear, or did you just say, oh, I
don't know. I was, you know, 17. I had no idea what I was doing. So just like, okay, well, I'll go make pretend. And, you know, I'll just cry because I'm sad. Okay, spoiler alert. The brother dies. The boyfriend kills him. And you have to cry at the funeral scene. I was like, okay. And then I started crying. Just with simple make pretend. It was like, you know, no technique whatsoever. But when I came to LA, I started studying 10 to 12, 1 to 4, and 7 to 10 every day.
Studying acting.
Yeah.
Any particular sort of recognizable? Like, I went to acting school. I studied with Sanford Meisner. And
I know somebody that was in the Meisner technique. I probably should have done that. But I went to a guy named Vincent Chase.
Uh-huh.
And it's funny because they used, I guess somebody that wrote or produced a show must have taken classes from him because he was a big acting coach around 1984, 85, 86. And he had a studio there on Sunset by La Brea or something like that. But the main character on The Entourage was named Vincent Chase. So I wonder who on that show studied with Vincent Chase.
Oh, it must have been a, yeah, it must have been a tie-in.
But my the coach under him was Mark Spiegel. He was my coach for years.
And, yeah. Did you like acting? I mean, because I know, you know, you really wanted to be a singer originally. I mean, did you have to make a decision of, well, now I'm going to put my singing on hold and become an actor?
No, I mean, I got a movie. Are you kidding me? I'm like, okay, I guess my life is taking me this direction. And, you know, you just go. You know, like, I was so young. I just went where the adventure took me. And it just seemed like it naturally veered in that direction. And after 6 months, I was on General Hospital, soap opera. And, you know, I still kept demoing songs. And I would perform little cabaret shows here and there. And,
right.
But it's almost been, you know, my passion on the side, but my job has been acting.
It's so interesting because I feel like there's barely any, I grew up watching soap operas on, you know, come home from school and we'd watch all the soap operas, be so into them. I don't know if the current sort of kids do that as much, but it was so much a part of our...
I think college kids do. I think they're still college kids or like their moms at home or grandmas at home, you know?
I definitely think that the parent and child dynamic of soap operas is still alive and well. Like, I always watch soap operas with my mom. If I had a sick day at school or high school or anything like that, I think that's still a thing. And the soaps are still have a major audience. I mean, it's a thriving, passionate audience.
Yeah.
And I really like that.
Maybe it's just me. I stopped watching General Hospital once Elizabeth Taylor wasn't on anymore.
Elizabeth Taylor. Oh, my gosh. I can't believe she was on General Hospital?
Yeah.
No, was it All My Children?
Or was it All My Children?
I shouldn't mix them up, but I might be.
Fact check. Well,
yeah, I know. Let's fact
that's
check.
That's what Ryan's usually in the booth fact checking me if I'm right. Were you a fan at all of movie musicals?
Grease. Grease was the one that I watched over and over again, and I actually conned my grandma, who raised me during my teenage years, to get me my first pair of spandex pants. So I could perform on stage with spandex pants like Sandy in Grease.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
When you were in L.A., and you said, so this would have been like the mid-80s, is this like when the Olympics? Or?
Yeah, I moved here in October of 84 when the Olympics were going on.
And what was L.A. like then? It just seems, were you running into other actresses? I mean, what was the vibe like?
I mean, I was so wide-eyed.
Were you living at the Oakwood or...?
I was from a little tiny pebble in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and I came to Los Angeles, this bustling metropolis already, and then you've got the people that are here for the Olympics on top of that. I'm like, I remember I had to negotiate my way around town because I was modeling, and we didn't have GPS back then, but we had map books.
Right.
Okay, 324 A.
Oh, I remember.
7.
Yes.
So that's how I learned Los Angeles with the Thomas Brothers map books.
Yes, I remember those. You'd have to have them in the back of your car and pull over.
Oh, my gosh. Driving and looking at a map book, and you have to change to another page and then turn back because it goes this way, that way. Oh, it was hilarious.
So when you were originally – now, I read in one of the – when you were doing the – got cast as Wayne's World – you had also had an audition for Baywatch?
Yeah. So it was one of those things where you reach a fork in the road and you're like, okay, which way do I go? And I had gone in for Baywatch first to play the marine biologist girlfriend to the Hoff. And then I heard about Wayne's World. And when I heard about the 17 to 23 Asian female, you know, hot, rockin', kicks butt, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, it will be mine. You know, it was one of those moments like, okay, how can we drag our feet on the other thing, you know, so that we can play this one out? And I hadn't even gone in for Wayne's World. But it took them a while to decide on the Baywatch thing, thank God. Yeah. And they wanted to do like a swimming test, so we put that off another week. It was sort of like, I could have lost both jobs, but yeah, my agent at the time was probably thinking, what the hell is wrong with this girl? But I just, that part in Wayne's World just really resonated with me, you know? I said, there's nobody that can sing it and act it and, you know, do martial arts. I mean, there's nobody. I'm going to do this part.
That's so amazing. Yeah, you willed it to happen.
Oh, I wanted it so bad. Sort of like this AJ and the Queen. It's just one of those things where the right part meets the right person at the right time, you know?
Right. That's true. It had essence. There was something I was looking at of myself and realizing how many scenes I'd shot in bars. Is there any kind of recurring? Do you one day look at yourself and like, man, I've done that. It seems to be a weird recurring. Do you have anything like that?
For me, it's like, how many different ethnic backgrounds can I play? Chinese, Japanese, Vietnamese, yes. Korean, you know, I still have to play Filipino. I went in for Modern Family doing a Filipino accent, but I didn't get that.
Oh.
but I understand now why.
So going back to Wayne's World, shot all here in Los Angeles.
Yeah, 33 days of principal photography in and around Los Angeles at Paramount Studios. And then they had a second unit that went to Chicago. So none of us went to Chicago.
Mm-hmm. And when you were on the set, the director of that was Penelope Spheeris.
Penelope Spheeris, who I just saw recently up in Idlewild for the there was a women's film festival up there. So they did a retrospective and they showed the movie, and it's pretty awesome.
So going back to that, I've done so many shows on TCM with female directors, and my recollection of that time was that it didn't seem odd to have a female director at all. It was only as in the 2000s when we started, I felt that it was all male directors. But was it at all a surprise to have a female director?
She was such a perfect fit because of her decline of the Western Civilization series of movies, and she's a rocker chick and just really steeped in that culture. So it was a perfect fit for her to go into Wayne's World, which is in that wheelhouse. But I think it's just that we noticed after that time, there were very, very few female directors.
Right.
Except we finally spoke up in the 2000s, like, hey, this is crazy with as many women that are out there, you know, buying movies, seeing movies. Why aren't there more of us helming them?
Yes.
So we got more vocal. That's all.
So when you're doing a film like that and everybody is funny on the set, does that make you rise to the occasion and want to be more funny? Or what's the feeling like when you're on a set like that?
Well, I always saw myself as a straight guy to the funny guys until AJ and the Queen, because I'm the foil to, you know, Mike Myers just, you know, doing his Wayne thing.
Right.
But I had to play it completely straight. And that's what makes the whole thing funny.
Yeah.
Is just,
but that's still an active part of it, you know.
Oh, I don't know. I never thought of myself as funny.
Really?
Yeah, I never thought of myself as funny.
Oh, that's interesting. Because, of course, because you can't. John Cleese for Monty Python said the key to their comedy is one person doing something funny and the other person
playing it very straight.
Playing it straight.
Yeah.
Because otherwise then it's not funny.
It's bouncing off the walls and it's too absurd.
You need the reactor or you need the deadpan.
Right.
So in that instance, you're us in a way going, what are you doing?
Yeah.
But you must have had fun on the set. Was there any kind of like breaking up or, you know?
It was such a whirlwind. For a studio picture of that magnitude to be shot in a month.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was the lowest budgeted film that year at Paramount. I think it was like a $12 million budget that went on to make like, I don't know, $250 million. But it was really just go, man. Go, get ready.
Right.
Get on set. You have one or two takes, you know? So it was run and gun. So it was just kind of magic that it all came together as well as it did, because I think the longest process was the revisions on the script.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had fuchsia, double fuchsia, chartreuse, double chartreuse, you know? So there was a lot of thinking and planning ahead.
Mm-hmm.
But once we got on set, it was just go.
So no ad libs or anything like that?
Not that I recalled. It was all very mapped out, mm-hmm. you know.
And when you went into the, were you surprised that they were going to do a sequel, or did you just know it was such a huge hit that there was?
Yeah, it was sort of, you know, a fait accompli. We knew yeah. with as much money as they made and how little they spent on the movie, I guess they're going to go and see if they can get some more of that. But the second one was bigger, better, faster, more, and it got away from the original core, the
right.
good-hearted, simple, small-town, you know, dynamic. That they rose up and they did something together, you know?
Right. Well, the second one had the crazy cast, though.
It was just huge. It was like Kim Basinger and Kevin Pollak and Drew Barrymore and
Charlton Heston.
Charlton Heston, that's right. Holy cow.
I mean, I was going to say, did you have any interaction with him? What was he?
I never met him on set.
So funny.
Yeah, everything was so, because everybody had their own little capsule.
Right.
In that we never... You know, whereas on the first one, everybody's around all the time.
Right.
But the second one was, you know, all the different star turns that came in had their own
yes.
separate time and space, and never the twain shall meet. You know?
The second director was Steven Sergeant, who mm-hmm. I actually worked with on a film called Weapons of Mass Distraction, which was an HBO film. But
ooh.
Any disappointment, and he's a wonderful guy.
He's a sweetheart.
He's a darling Canadian man. Mm-hmm. But was there any, had you developed a rapport with Penelope and then now had to develop a new rapport with another director? Or you just did your job?
Yeah, I just did my job. I mean, I didn't know if like maybe Penelope didn't want to do the second one or whatever,
right.
you know, because we weren't privy to the behind the scenes on that. And I was just glad to be invited to the party. So I'm like, okay.
That's too bad.
Penelope's not here, but okay.
Yeah.
But he's really nice and, you know.
Yes, he's a very sweet person. So then the next movie you did was what you worked with James Cameron.
Was that the next one? Yeah, I think that was True Lies with
yeah.
Arnold and
another
Jamie
huge
Lee.
Film.
Huge. I mean I've knocked
huge.
On wood. That's it. After that, I don't need to do anything else. But then I kept going because I'm stubborn and it's the only thing I'm qualified to do. But
I noticed two movies alone, you could do conventions for the rest of your. That's
trust
always like,
and honestly. Believe.
Yeah. So I mean, a huge film.
It was so much fun because they had so much money and it was like a year of shooting.
Wow.
So we went from $12 million, 33 days, and then we had a year and $100 million. And it was such a spectacle. And I remember going down to Key Biscayne, one of those keys, down in Florida. And it was a big explosion thing where Arnold jumps into the water, the flames go above him, explosions all around. And I had to sit in my trailer 5 days in a row because the explosions didn't go off just right.
Wow.
Because it was so choreographed. And, you know, the rubber cement was supposed to, you know, catch on fire and lead to this, you know, thing of, you know, whatever, gasoline, whatever they do, it's supposed
right.
to blow up, and it didn't go. And yeah, it was a huge, huge spectacle. It's amazing.
And did you have any interaction with Jamie Lee Curtis, who really pops in the film?
Oh, yeah. She was awesome. I first worked with her on Anything But Love.
Wow.
Yeah, with Richard Lewis.
Yes, I remember that show.
Yeah, on TV.
That was a good show.
It was a really good show. And I played his like, I forget, it was like his Thai adoptive daughter. Like, he donated like $9 a month to his adopted daughter in Thailand. And I come and visit, and he has all these weird feelings for me. And he tortures himself because he has these feelings for his... Anyway, it's... It's just very awkward. But I worked with Jamie Lee on that, and I was like, oh my gosh. I was kind of scared of her because she's such a powerful personality, and I just felt very sheepish. So it was nice the second time where I was more mature and
yes.
able to meet her where she is, and just she's just a great ballsy broad, and I like that about her.
I think that's always a challenge of actually, we had a character actor last week on the show, John Carroll Lynch, and we were talking about when you were playing a supporting role. You know, you have to come in and you're working with, you know, you don't
big
have
stars.
Yeah, you don't have as much time. They don't, you know, so you really have to have a lot of confidence just
yeah.
to be just ready and do up. Your job and not ask a lot of questions.
Come prepared, know your lines, be fluid in case stuff changes, you know.
Are you a question asker? I have a feeling you're, or do you just sort of act like, this is cool, I got this.
Yeah, I read the script. I know my part. I know how I feel about what other people are doing to me, so I can react to them properly. But I don't stay stuck to an image of how I'm going to play it, obviously, because then I go to set, and then the director has a different take on it. So yeah. it's a fine line between knowing all your stuff by rote, but then also being open to direction so that they can, you know, steer you how they want to see you.
Were you surprised? Because, again, in the show that you're doing now, it seems like it's more of a comedic turn. Were you surprised that after Wayne's World you did so many action films?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like I said,
well,
I never thought of
incredible.
Myself as...
incredible. I mean, no, you did. You still look incredible.
Oh,
but...
thanks. I was at the right place at the right time, and I was the right flavor.
That was
know?
The era of, you know, those action. That was the height of all the action movies, it seems.
It was perfect because going from Wayne's World and the wacky comedy to, like, the sexy vixen, dangerous, Bond-esque, villainess, you know, it was... It showed a lot of, you know, oh, you can cast her in this and you can cast her in that. And then in Rising Sun with Sean Connery playing a computer whiz with my hair slicked back and all that stuff. So I've gotten to run the gamut in that. But I think, like I said, I never thought of myself as being funny until AJ and the Queen. Because when I read it, I'm like, oh, my gosh, I finally get to be funny and disgusting and vulgar and, like, you know, like, I don't care. And it's sort of where I am right now. I'm much more daring and less self-conscious because I looked a certain way back then and that was my currency. And I was always like, oh, my stomach's sticking out and I want to, you know, I felt like sometimes when I saw my performances, I'm like, why are you posing, Tia? Stop it. You know,
right.
But it was this hyper awareness of how you look and knowing that that's what got you there in the first place.
Well, I also think, I'm not sure, but that James Cameron doesn't seem like a guy that would give you a lot of sensitive motivation for things. He's busy working on the big picture, so.
Well, it's kind of funny because he does have that side of him, which is like, I want the lights this way and I want the explosion to go like that.
Right.
And he's very, very on top of his camera crew and his lighting crew and his effects crew, but with I couldn't believe me, you know, I don't know, 10th guy in the totem pole for a True Lies. He goes, so Tia, is there something? He played playback for me. He said, so is there anything you would do differently with this? Is there, how do you feel about that? And I went, oh my gosh, you know what? I'm slouching a little. I think that she would be standing up more and presenting more. I feel like I should present the nuclear weapon more. Like, you know, Vanna White. And he goes, yeah, let's try it like that. And I couldn't believe that he was giving me that permission and inviting me into the conversation of how I would do it. And he, even in the studio doing looping for the film, he said, so we're going to do this and blah, 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 and we need to replace these lines. And I said, can I hear it? And I listened to it. And I'm like, you know, my voice sounds really high and thin. Do you mind if I do the whole thing and pitch my voice down? He's like, yeah, so we, you know, I love how, although he is a tech guy and with the big spectacle, but very specific and very nurturing with the actors at the same time. And that's why he's such a great director.
The director of Rising Sun was Philip Kaufman.
Kaufman, The Right Stuff.
Yeah, which is an incredible film.
I'm the luckiest girl ever. I mean, you know, I always feel like, oh, I'm still striving. I'm still on that treadmill going nowhere. But, you know, when I talk about it with you, I'm like, you know what? I can just relax on the beach in, you know, Havana and just rest on my laurels.
You could be doing conventions for the rest of your...
harder work.
Where did they film Rising Sun?
Rising Sun was at 20th Century Fox.
Aww.
The now...
Defunct
20th Century Fox. Wow. I have a tote bag, though, so it proves that there was one once.
Yeah,
it's crazy, man.
I wonder if our residuals will still say 20th Century Fox or if they'll say 20th Century.
I wonder. Well, the latest, my latest listing, my latest listing, I did see 20th Century Fox. I have not seen the name change over yet.
That's what I thought of it. You check your residuals too.
Trust and believe.
Favorite. The lottery and then the residual portal is my two favorite things.
Well, and then retirement.
Oh, that's, we can, that's true.
That's amazing. My girlfriend told me that we got retirement.
Aren't you relieved now that you became an actress?
Yeah.
It's so interesting.
Because musicians don't have that. I mean, you know, I don't think so.
Yeah, it's so funny because when you start out, people say you need a fallback profession. And I never thought about a pension or anything like that. But now I'm thinking, God, thank God I became an actor.
Yeah, my girlfriend just turned 55 and she's like, happy birthday, Julie McCullough. And she's like, I'm going to get to trigger my pension. I'm like, that's awesome. I'm right behind you.
When you worked, so we were talking about Philip Kaufman in Rising Sun. Did he give you any interesting direction? I don't know much about Philip Kaufman.
He's very soft-spoken and mm-hmm. very gentle. And that's why he got all those amazing performances in the right Stuff.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, we had Harvey Keitel. We had, Sean Connery. We had all these amazing people.
Mako,
yeah.
From the Sand Pebbles.
I don't know
if you've ever seen.
I've never seen.
Yeah.
That was one of my favorite movies when I was a kid.
Oh.
It's a sad movie. The Sand Pebbles. Steve McQueen. It used to be on constantly when I was a kid.
Yeah, I don't remember. Yeah, I vaguely remember seeing it, but I have to revisit.
He's like the main thing in the film, Mako. Mm-hmm.
It's just the Wonderful two of them. Actor. It's just the two of them, isn't it?
Yeah. And
I gotta watch that again. It'll just make me sad, though.
Oh. He'll be there forever in the film.
We all will.
In the film business. But so then you did Rising Sun, and then now you're at the top of your career. Did you have a strategy then of being at all these big films and saying, now I want to do an independent film, now I want to work on my singing career?
I wish I had done independent film. I was with someone who was a producer that also steered my career, and I think some of the decisions were not probably best for me. They were best for the company, and so I ended up doing a bunch of films that weren't really helpful. I think I should have worked mm-hmm. with other fine filmmakers, people that went to Sundance and did, great work.
Right.
But it was more about building a library for a new company. So it's kind of, mm-hmm. a mixed bag of, whatever. We make decisions based on the information we have at the time.
But what's so interesting, we were talking about the show, the reason Netflix is so, I think it's like the new independent film. Mm-hmm. And AJ and the Queen would be an independent film. That would be a small movie that would be in limited release.
People would see at the, fringe festivals. It's really great that there are so many outlets mm-hmm. for properties that wouldn't be seen anywhere. If you didn't fit ABC, NBC, CBS, or the big tentpole event films at the Cineplex, you were out of luck, mm-hmm. So now you have people that are making little movies in their hometowns and putting them out there, and they're getting seen, and good work rises to the top, mm-hmm. which is great. It's the great democratization of film and television.
You said something interesting before, because I think that this show, from what you were saying, is going to give you an opportunity. You've played all these characters, and I think that people have an impression of you from the films, but now you're going to get to be you, Tia. Is that scary or exhilarating?
It's exhilarating, and it has been since I first read the sides, the script scene that I had to audition with. Mm-hmm. I was reading it with my sister. I was, and she's like, oh my gosh, Tia, that's the thing that most sounds like you that you've ever done. I'm like, mm-hmm. thank you. Because I'm like this really obnoxious, really like, kind of character, and but it's liberating because it's so freeing to be without the constraints of polite behavior and being worried about looking a certain way. It was mm-hmm. really a lot of fun. And one of the scenes, the guy Josh Segarra, Hector Damien in it, he and I have conned Rue out of his money, and he is more concerned about his abs and eating plain grilled chicken and that he's gained 2 pounds. And I'm sitting there going, munching down on like 20 Egg McMuffins. And I thought to myself, I have finally got my dream job. It was amazing that I wasn't the person worried about like fitting into the bikini.
That's funny. So, so let's, for people who haven't seen the show, walk us through the basic premise of the show. I know a little bit about it. RuPaul, obviously, is the star of it, and he's playing a drag queen, and he runs it, and you're the one who you steal money from him, so then he has to go on the road, but you'll do a better description than me.
Yes, well, I mean, that was perfect. That's exactly it. You said it. Okay, done. Moving on. But, no, so RuPaul plays a character named Ruby Red decides that he's going to open his own drag club. He saved a bunch of money up, $100,000. Like, I'm not giving away too much because it's in the first episode. But his new boyfriend makes off with all the money, and you find out that I'm in cahoots. And so he has to go back on the road in a beat-up old RV from town to town, slugging it out to earn that money again. In the course of it, a little stowaway, a little 10-year-old stowaway in the form of AJ wants to go on this trip with him. And he's like, no, I can't take a kid with me to all these drag clubs and the unlikely friendship. And ultimately, they find each other as sort of their little family on this motorhome. And it's great because you don't... if you look at everyone, they're not what they appear on the surface. There is much more to them. And I love the depth of discovering and uncovering each character that it would be easy to write off as just that. And then you find out, wow, they've got a heart and a soul and they're, you know, kind. And it's sad how they got into the situation or whatever it is, you know. It's great.
Yeah. Plus, it's very interesting because, of course, you see RuPaul in drag and out of drag, which is very poignant, you know, some of the scenes that I saw. So that's must be very interesting, too, you know, dealing with him as an actor when he's in drag versus unmasked and himself.
He's stunning in drag. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I feel so ugly next to you. He's like 7 feet tall, Amazon with this mane of red hair and like this flames, red and blue, and sequin and crust. I'm like, oh my gosh. Swarovski. You must have
Were you a fan of drag queens before, being in a show with drag queens?
I've always loved going to drag shows.
Yeah, it's fun.
I've gone, you know, whenever I'm shooting in a town, we'll go to see a drag show in the local bar. I've done that probably half a dozen times on different locations around the world. So it's definitely, I love the pageantry and the biting sarcasm and the cattiness. I just think it's hilarious. But I've also loved RuPaul because I know that he has gone on a journey in the course of his career. And he references Oprah a lot in the show, but I feel like he is very Oprah-esque in the way he is and has become a very deep thinker because of the decades in his career that he's had to go on this long and arduous journey himself. I did his podcast right after we did the show, and it was great to see that other side of him, too. He's a very deep thinker. And
Once you're cast in the show, another thing that I have found working on some of these, you know, that are not network shows is that they really value your input. And the writers on the show, was there any input into your character that you wanted to play? You said one of the things was you got to eat more.
Michael Patrick King did Sex in the City. Are you kidding me? I mean, he and the whole crew of writers there, they had everything down dialogue-wise. And I think the biggest thing for me is trying to figure out where her voice was. I guess maybe being a singer, I'm always thinking about where her voice is. Like I've done movies where, oh God, she sounds too strong to be that, the sad, damaged, whiny woman. I should have pitched my voice up, or like I said in True Lies, pitching my voice down. This one was, he wanted Lady Danger, my character, Lady Danger, to have this catchphrase of, wow. and I think it's because as I understand it, I don't know if this is true or not, but I heard that Joni Marchenko, who's, you know, the writer-producer on it also, that she has a way of saying, wow. So he wanted to make that into sort of her, you know, Lady Danger's catchphrase. But I had to find a, I sort of put on this sort of Asian accent, but I'm from Hawaii. So it was sort of like this mix of accent with that one catchphrase. So I was trying to figure out what I would sound like. And I love the way it came out. I love the way it all came together.
Did you have an input on the way you looked and your costumes?
Yes, sort of, but it was very out of my comfort zone. Way out of my comfort zone. Tracy Gigi Field, who did the costumes, was always bringing these insane, like, super colorful bomber jacket with, like, these tight, you know, pants, but, like, pink and blue and yellow and orange and green. I'm like, oi. I usually wear chic, you know, black and shoulder pads and whatever, you know, kind of hip, cool, rock and roll or whatever. But she was going for $28 on Amazon kind of, you know, mama-san kind of clothes, you know, online with Jimmy Choo shoes and a Birkin purse. But it was a very specific sort of insane way of dressing that was very hard for me to deal with. But it works to get, you know, it's a character.
Right. Once you see it on screen.
Not my druthers, but it was awesome because Lady Danger looks insane as she is supposed to be. She wears a doggone eye patch, for God's sake.
Does that costuming at all help you get into character as the series progresses? Did it help you or maybe give you any ideas for your performance?
Well, I just realized there is no over the top because there is no top with Lady Danger. She's just like, I'm just going to walk around and own this place just because this outfit makes me feel like that. She doesn't conform to anything, not for nobody.
And is it the same director for every episode or is it different directors?
Different directors, but MPK, Michael Patrick King, did a bunch of them and was always on set. I think it was like five different directors.
And what kind of tone is he looking for overall? Do you automatically know? Like you said, there's no, you know, bottom. It's just totally over the top. But yet there's this emotional depth in it.
Yeah, I was kind of being glib. I mean, there is, of course, a top. I wasn't looking to be, you know, absurd or whatever, but I was just put in absurd situations. It was still played very realistically, I think, strangely enough.
Well, the drag world, and you know, you've seen so many shows about the, you know, balls and stuff. There's a lot of drama going on.
It's like a hyper realism.
Yeah.
So it's not like we're trying to do a documentary of going to, you know, Kentucky or Tennessee or whatever, but it was a more glamorized version. So we could shoot it on the back lot at, you know, at Warner Brothers.
And so do you ever go on the actual locations or are they just for now, you know, pretending that we're in a city?
Yeah, just pretending. It was all in and around Los Angeles.
Obviously you don't know if the show is going to come back or maybe you do.
I know, knock on wood. We're waiting. I mean, we've got to know in the next little while. I think the first few weeks of binging, hear that at home, turn it on.
And where would you, if the show came back, where would you want to see your character go?
I would want to see my character go to more expensive clothing stores. No.
That's just so you can take stuff home.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I didn't take any of the clothes home. I was scared of them. Just more of the same because it was a blast working on it.
Yes.
I was going to ask real quick, now that you're, you know, you studied this foray of comedic roles, is there any comedic actor or performer that you'd love to work off of in the future, whether it's on AJ and the Queen or in a future project, a dream?
I mean, as we go over my filmography, I mean, I feel like I've lived, you know, 10 lives at this point, not even getting into what I've done in my musical life. I just pinch myself every day. I'm just grateful for where I am now, but I can't think of any number of people I would love to work with. Holy cow.
You have worked with a ton of.
I have worked with a ton of people. I mean, funny guy. I mean, right now I'm binging on Netflix. I'm binging The Office with my daughter, and Steve Carell is just killing me on the show. Rainn Wilson. Oh my gosh,
All such funny actors.
So funny. So, yeah. I mean, maybe because they're top of mind and I'm watching them on TV right now, it would be amazing to work with them. But wow. There's so many people I'd love to work with.
Did you have any movies? We were talking at the top of the show just about the Oscar movies. Did you have any movies this year that were that really that you loved or that popped out at you?
Two of the best movies of recent history. And I can't think of two other movies that come even close. Parasite.
Yeah.
And The Joker.
Yeah.
Because I was like, Marvel movie, what? Holy cow. Both of those films really hit me.
Yeah.
And I couldn't even think, a close second to those.
Wow.
I can't remember a movie that I enjoyed. Not enjoyed is a bad word, but,
right.
Just was that, affected by. That
exactly.
Really stayed with you after watching it.
I just thought that the variety of films this year was...
It was a miraculous year.
Yeah, Marriage Story.
The Netflix one, too. Even mm-hmm. Some of the ones that are more offbeat, like The Lighthouse, they're all... Like just
very
crazy
diverse.
Array, Little Women,
It's quite an array. I want to see that.
It's quite an array of directors. I don't know. Do you find it some more? I feel like for actresses that there was a time where it felt like, well, I guess this is it. It's over. And then now I feel like now is the greatest time ever where I feel more hopeful than I felt in the past 10 years for acting and auditioning opportunities,
I feel like back when I first started out, women had to look a certain way.
Right.
They had to be a certain age and that was it and it's done. But now, maybe because we have more women mm-hmm. directors and writers and producers,
right.
we want to be seen at a different place mm-hmm. in our lives where we can identify with. They're not all stuck at 28,
Right.
We want to see our stories told now. More shape inclusivity, so everybody doesn't have to be a size 4, mm-hmm. I remember when I would go to borrow gowns for things. I'm like, are you kidding me? Nothing in this entire showroom fits me right now? I'm offended. But, it's a different time when you have, people like Chrissy Metz and, Octavia Spencer and, amazing women that are killing it on the big screen, on the TV screen. And they don't fit into that little, you're a pretty mm-hmm. little, toy woman, girl.
Yes.
You're not even a woman. You're a girl.
Yeah.
And that's where we were relegated to back in the day.
I was thinking as we were talking, have you ever been on The View? You should be on The View. You'd be
Let
perfect.
Me tell you this about that, and I'm going to tell you another
Uh-oh.
Thing. Yeah, it'd be great. There's a lot of people talking, though. It's hard to. I would feel, I don't want to step on what they're saying.
It's hard. I did The View. My hint is as with everything, come out and say what you have to say. Boom! Like literally,
drop it like a hammer.
Because then the rest of the time you're going to have a hard time getting the chance to talk. But I agree with you. You want to be. You're like, I'm doing a nice interview, and then it's over.
There's a lot of people talking, and they've been on there, and they have their shorthand with each other, and you feel like you're improvising on Curb Your Enthusiasm, and there's six people in the scene. Where do I jump in? I don't want to step on anybody else's line.
Well, it could be because you have when you have a movie background, you always think the director is going to say cut, and then you'll have another opportunity.
Yeah, no.
Not for live television.
Go in and grab the spotlight.
Did you go through that whole rounds of, back in the day, of the Lenos and the Lettermans and those kind
of
shows?
I did Letterman. I did Conan. I did Arsenio.
Wow.
I did Keenan Ivory Wayans' show.
Yeah.
I could
add a few. I did the Howie Mandel.
Oh, that's right. Howie Mandel had
Donnie
one.
And Marie had a show. Rosie.
Rosie. Yeah.
Did you
ever invited to that?
Did you enjoy those experiences, or were they nerve wracking?
I don't. Maybe I was just so young and stupid and not aware.
Yeah.
I just walked along and just. I was just holding on for dear life. I was happy to be invited, and I was trying not to trip on my own feet. And,
yes.
You know, I was so young. I was, what, 23, 24?
Uh-huh.
I wish I could go through it now with that sort of...
Yes, now you have all the...
If I knew then what I know now, one of those old things, you know?
I know. Just putting together your resume from all the... Do you stay in touch with any of the people that you worked with on some of your films?
Well, John Lovitz is a good friend of mine. We worked together on High School High many years ago. I spoken to Dana Carvey a few times, but it's hard to get together, you know? And
yeah.
I saw Mike Myers over at the Oscar parties last time around. Hawk Koch, who's the producer on Wayne's World. I've seen him a bit. We used to be neighbors up in Topanga. On top of a mountain far, far away from everybody else. Says, you know, here and there, but, you know.
It's nice to be, I was saying at the top of the show, it's just the nice time of the season just to see people and talk about their films and reminisce and share experiences and, you know, be part of the community and the family, cinema family.
Yeah, and then you lose people after, like I saw Peter Fonda at the Oscar parties last year. And then I heard he had passed away. I'm like, wait, I just saw him.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm glad that I got to see him and, you know, send him love and, oh, and so nice to see you. I worked with him on a couple of films. And,
oh, what a nice guy
he
was.
Yeah, such a nice guy. Such a nice guy. Like Luke Perry. That was a shock. Came out of nowhere. We were supposed to get together and go to a party. And next thing I know, you know, so like just being grateful for the time that we have together and.
Right.
This whole Kobe thing, holy cow, that just happened right near my house. I mean, you just, you know, hug your loved ones, tell the people you love them, and just soak it all in because nothing is promised.
Oh, it's been a crazy week for that, I feel. I think more so than in the past, I've never seen just people react in just such an effective way. Like, everyone really is now kind of realizing, wow, I mean, like, you just got to be present.
You really do. And I mean, that is 13-year-old daughter. I mean, having a 14-year-old daughter myself, I just can't even imagine the pain that her mom is going through right now. I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
It was really depressing. And, you know, it was the Grammys and all that. And I almost didn't want to go anywhere, but I thought, you know, it was for a benefit, this thing that I went to that night.
Right.
And, you know, just show up and do your thing. But, you know, if you see people, give them a hug and give them a kiss and I love you and I, you know, let's get together and really mean it and get together.
And it's a shame of a tragedy. It takes a tragedy for us to really think that way, where it's a reminder in a way. And I wish it didn't take that.
Yeah, well, but, it's human nature to start running again and galloping towards our goals stuff. But I don't know. I think maybe where I am in my life right now, I am much more aware and present. Like, you're asking me questions about doing Letterman back in the day. It was just such a blur.
Right.
But now I am every single moment
present.
Really there
and
soaking everything up.
Before you go, I did want to talk a little bit about your singing.
That's a whole nother show.
What? So tell me about some of your singing, and are you working on anything currently?
Well, like I said, I was growing up and I was singing and I sang at the Waikiki Shell and entered every contest there was back in Hawaii with my childhood friend Daniel Ho.
Mm-hmm.
Cut to, we both moved to Los Angeles and we were talking about working together on music, and he's beginning to work in Hawaiian music. And so he said, hey, let's get together and do a record of all your favorite Hawaiian music. And we did that and we got nominated for a Grammy, and then did another one of all original music that Daniel wrote, and that won the Grammy. Did another one, got nominated, and then did the final one, our fourth album, and won the second Grammy. So
great.
I mean, with my childhood friend that I've known since I was 14, so it couldn't be any sweeter than to go on that journey with somebody that, you know, went to the all-boys Catholic school down the street while I went to the all-girls Catholic school up the street, and, you know, just farting around on the piano and just singing some, I don't know, New York medleys or whatever the hell we were doing.
I think, what is the tradition of Hawaiian singing? I know I did a film in Hawaii and it was wonderful to hear people play
the ukulele. And the slack key guitar. Well, what's funny is the slack key guitar is is a style, because the Portuguese had left the stringed instruments behind in Hawaii and didn't teach them how to tune them. Mm-hmm. So you could create your own tuning.
I see.
And, okay, this is how I'm going to tune my guitar, and then you play it, and it sounds differently than if you tuned it, you know, in the traditional, you know.
Yeah, very high.
It's, well, it could be high or low or whatever, anything, but, like, Daniel's got his own tuning for certain songs that he plays.
Right.
And it's pretty cool.
Oh, I love the Hawaiian ukulele. Music.
Yeah, yeah.
Every once in a while, I have a couple CDs, and I'll put on my...
I should have brought my CDs.
Yeah, well...
Shoot! I'll have to get an address where I can send it to you.
Well, since we're on the air, what are a couple of your CDs if people want to get them?
If you want the hard copy of the CD, you go to TiaCarrere.com.
Okay.
TiaCarrere.com. But it's also on iTunes, so you can listen to the songs and just buy them one at a time.
Well, I'm a big proponent of Hawaiian music. I love, maybe a good.
It's the open vowels. I think that it's a feeling, the, you know, the
very
resonance.
Heartfelt.
Yeah, the open vowels and the vibration of that. It's very beautiful.
Plus, as they said, when we worked there, the hair and makeup lady, every night she'd make drinks and Mai Tais. It was so much fun. I was like, I want to do every movie in Hawaii.
What movie is this? Why wasn't I on it? That's my question.
It was actually a lot of fun. It was a wedding planner movie. We played a family of wedding planners.
I'm going to have to look it up on your filmography.
I think it was called The Knot. But anyway, we filmed it entirely in Turtle Bay and different parts.
Oh, man, that's awesome.
I never wanted to go home. It was incredible.
Yeah, I got to do one movie there, You May Not Kiss the Bride, with Rob Schneider and Catherine McVie. That was fun, getting to shoot in Hawaii. But I don't get to shoot in Hawaii enough. I got to go and create my own movies.
You
got to
go back to that grocery store.
I don't even know if it's still there.
Oh.
I wonder. I'm going to have to Google that.
We'll check it out.
All right. Well, Tia, thank you so much for being on the show. The show is called
AJ and the Queen.
And it's on Netflix.
On Netflix. Binge it. Feel free.
Binge it. And you'll love it. I've seen it. And it's fantastic. I hope it comes back.
Me too.
I'd love to be in a show. I love drag queens.
And we got to be sure to check out Ileana on Shrill.
My show, which is on Shrill, which is on Hulu.
Ooh, cool.
Currently on. I know. God bless all of these networks.
Yeah.
With Adi Bryan, who's fantastic and so funny.
Awesome. I'll check it out.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here. As we end the show, as we always do, we like to say everyone's life is a movie. Today was a big blockbuster movie with a beginning and a middle and an end. And thank you again for being on the show. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Have a great day. Bye.
Thanks for tuning into The Film Scene with Ileana Douglas, airing exclusively on the Popcorn Talk Network. We bring you this show for free because we're just as passionate and borderline obsessed with film as you are. And it would mean a lot if you would please subscribe to our podcast and give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. It takes 5 minutes to review the show, but it helps other film junkies find the show and continue to spread a love of classic and contemporary film. For guest inquiries or live bookings, you can email me, Jeff Graham, at guests@afterbuzztv.com. That's GUESTS@AFTERBUZZ.com. For more incredible film content, check us out online at The Popcorn Talk, and we'll see you after the credits.